He talks about that in his writings and in his manual in 1904 that he puts out in Looking for Human Remains. And so, as we note in the article, the largest racial group in the United States that was that had brains taken was Black Americans, and it's unclear what the Smithsonian will do about that.
Well, we'll continue to follow the story, as I'm sure both of you will. Claire Healy and Nicole Dunca of The Washington Post. We will link to your remarkable investigative series revealing the Smithsonian's racial brain collection. That does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feltz, Dina Guzder, Messiah Rhodes, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Tammy Warnoff, Trina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Ravi Karan, Hani Masood, Sanji Lopez. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. Special thanks to Becca Staley, John Randolph, Paul Powell, Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Noguera, Hugh Grant, Dennis Moynihan. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
On the next episode of Voices for the Animals, we'll look into the case of a goat, a girl, and the rise of more compassionate and humane alternatives to 4-H agricultural programs. We'll be speaking with Danielle Hanisch, Executive Director of LEAP, Leaders for Ethics, Animals, and the Planet. It's a program that offers students the farm animal care experience and opportunities of 4-H without the selling of those animals for slaughter, which can traumatize many kids.
These kids were, 14, 15, 16 years old and just realizing, like someone flipped a switch that, oh my gosh, these animals are no different than my dogs and cats at home. They have feelings, they have personalities. And now I'm knee deep in this program and I don't think that there's another option and I have to betray my friend who I have cared for.
We've got your goat on the next Voices for the Animals, airing Friday, August 25th at 10 a.m. right here on 90.7 KBOO FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Finance Committee will meet twice in August via public video conference. The Finance Committee meeting will be on Thursday, August 10th at 5:30, and again on Thursday, August 24th at 5:30 p.m. A public link and phone number to attend the virtual meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM. Get ready for the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Portland selects a new map for city council elections, its first in over 100 years.
A judge rules Washington County must release criminal defendants after 10 days without a public defender.
And in national news, Hurricane Hillary is poised to hit the southwestern U.S. on Saturday.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 18th, 2023. I'm Althea Billings.
And I'm Josh Salem. Portland's new city council electoral map is almost finished. The Districting Commission voted Wednesday to move forward with the alder map, and it'll be up for a final vote on Monday. Portlanders passed a landmark charter change measure last fall, breaking the city up into districts that would each elect three city councilors. Before this, city councilors were elected citywide. Historically, that's meant that city commissioners have been from wealthier, whiter neighborhoods, most often on the west side of the river. District 1 is the area east of I-205. District 2 includes North and Northeast Portland, north of Sandy Boulevard. District 3 encompasses inner southeast, so west of I-205 and south of Sandy. District 4 is the entire west side of the river, plus Selwood, East Moreland, and Reed College. The Independent Districting Commission had a number of factors to consider, mainly equal population size, connectedness, and not dividing communities of interest. All four districts will have an election in 2024, But in District 3 and 4, it'll just be a two-year term, so the elections to city council are staggered. Portland is expected to see more politicians in office that represent the interests of lower-income and racially diverse neighborhoods. After the final vote Monday, Portlanders interested in running for office may start announcing their candidacy. They've been waiting to see which part of the city they'd represent.
The Washington County Sheriff's Office must release people accused of a crime after 10 days if they can't find a public defender to represent them. That's according to a new order that Federal District Judge Michael McShane issued on Tuesday. Currently, there are 36 people in the Washington County Jail without legal counsel, so it applies to them and any future defendants. The Sixth Amendment guarantees the right to an attorney. If defendants can't afford an attorney on their own, the state is supposed to appoint one. Oregon is in a long-standing public defender crisis, meaning there aren't enough public defenders to represent all of the people accused of a crime in Oregon. In total, 2,580 defendants across the state are without a lawyer, and 164 of them are in jail. Oregon is the only state in the nation whose public defender system relies entirely on contractors. The American Bar Association found that the state has only 31% of the public defenders that it needs. Judge McShane wrote, quote, "It's a systematic statewide problem. It needs to be addressed quickly because we can't simply hold people in custody without representation for indefinite periods of time. It's an embarrassment to the state," end quote.
Hurricane Hilary is predicted to hit the southwest United States this Saturday, and it might extend into early next week. The storm was initially called a tropical storm, but it became way more intense on Thursday going into Friday. It's now classified as a Category 4 hurricane. The storm is currently about 400 miles off the coast of Cabo San Lucas, Mexico, with winds reaching upwards of 145 miles per hour. It's projected to hit a portion of northwestern Mexico, California, Nevada, and Arizona. Officials are worried that Hurricane Hilary will bring serious flooding. They estimate that it could dump more than a year's worth of rain in California, Arizona, and Nevada. Hilary has triggered the first ever tropical storm watch for California. State officials have assessed it to be a level 4 of 4 threat, also the first to ever be issued for this part of Southern California. The last tropical storm that hit California was 84 years ago. Heavy rainfall is expected to begin in the southwest tomorrow, lasting through early next week, with the most intense downpours likely on Sunday and Monday. Southern parts of California and Nevada could receive 3 to 5 inches of rain. Prolonged rain may oversaturate the ground and overwhelm waterways, potentially worsening the flood threat. Oregon won't see nearly as much rain as California, but parts of eastern Oregon may still get a downpour or two.
Fulton County proposes a March 4th trial date for former President Donald Trump. The Georgia grand jurors who voted to indict Trump received threats, and a new law could bring new restrictions for North Carolina voters. With more on these stories, it's Alex Gonzalez with 2023 Talks.
Welcome to 2023 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
I think we can expect him to take the reins and move things forward.
Former District Attorney for DeKalb County, Gwen Keys Fleming, said she's confident in Judge Robert McBurney's abilities as he presides over the grand jury investigation looking into former President Donald Trump and his allies' efforts to overturn the results of the 2020 presidential election in Georgia. Fulton County District Attorney Fannie Willis has proposed a March 4th trial date, which is likely to receive pushback from Trump's legal team, as it would place Trump on trial a day before the Super Tuesday primary contest. Meanwhile, Georgia Republican Senator Colton Moore is calling for a special session to examine Willis's actions. Georgia Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene appeared on Real America's Voice and had harsh words for prosecutors.
As a matter of fact, they are election meddling. They should be charged with racketeering and conspiracy RICO charges on a federal level. These people need to be removed from office.
The Georgia grand jurors who voted to indict Trump earlier this week have been receiving online threats. Under Georgia law, jurors' names are made available to the public. Their names and addresses have been posted on pro-Trump forums, with one user writing, "These jurors have signed their death warrant by falsely indicting President Trump." During a Thursday appearance on CBS Mornings, North Dakota Governor and GOP presidential candidate Doug Burgum said leaders on both sides of the aisle can't be trusted, but deflected when asked about Trump's current legal battles.
We need leadership that people can trust. Right now, we're not seeing that in either party.
The North Carolina legislature passed a bill this week which would add 20 provisions to alter election processes for voters. The bill heads to Governor Roy Cooper's desk, who slammed the Republican-backed legislation. The GOP holds a supermajority in the General Assembly and could override a veto. Chantel Stevens with the ACLU of North Carolina says the bill would make it harder for voters to cast mail-in ballots.
Contrary to what some would have you believe, these proposed changes are not about fairness or balance. They are thinly veiled attempts to manipulate the electoral system in favor of those who seek to consolidate their power.
Finally, President Joe Biden and First Lady Jill Biden are set to travel to Maui Monday after wildfires on the island claimed the lives of more than 100 people. In an interview earlier this week, Hawaii Representative Jill Takuda suggested the island's alarm warning system likely had failed. But on Wednesday, Maui County Emergency Management Administrator Herman Andaya said he did not regret not sounding the alarms during the wildfires.
The sirens, as I mentioned earlier, is used primarily for tsunamis, and that's the reason why many of them are found, almost all of them are found, on the coastline.
I'm Alex Gonzalez for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
It's becoming increasingly popular for people to use DNA testing to learn more about their ancestry and genetic makeup. But even when people specify that they only want their DNA used for that specific purpose, it may not be safe from utilization by police. The Intercept reports that there's a sneaky backdoor into private data in the popular DNA site GEDmatch, and it remains unknown how much of it has been accessed or how often. KBOO's Grant Button has the details.
Police are getting DNA data from people who think they opted out. That's according to an article published today by The Intercept. It exposed a loophole in the online DNA data filing website GEDmatch. Genealogists can work with law enforcement and use commercial DNA databases to search for people who can help them identify unknown human remains or perpetrators who left DNA at a crime scene. The field exploded in 2018 after a genealogist built an elaborate family tree to find the Golden State Killer, leading to the arrest of Joseph James DeAngelo. Since then, hundreds of otherwise unresolved cases have been solved using this technique by searching for DNA from online databases such as FamilyTree DNA and GEDmatch. But this practice remains highly controversial because it involved combing through the genetic information of hundreds of thousands of innocent people without many limits or regulations. Tiffany Roy is a DNA expert and lawyer. She said, quote, "These investigations have serious consequences. They involve people who have never been suspected of a crime. At the very least, law enforcement actors should have a warrant to conduct a genetic genealogy search. Anything less is a serious violation of privacy," end quote. The loophole in GEDmatch gives law enforcement a backdoor to accessing protected profiles. It's unknown how common this practice is, but sources told The Intercept that the GEDmatch loophole had long been an open secret before becoming public in late July. For KBOO News, I'm Grant Button.
A bill in the U.S. House of Representatives has the potential to almost eliminate local input on zoning for placement of cell phone towers. Along with the prospect of harmful effects on wildlife, some local elected officials are voicing concerns about the precedent this could set if it passes. Edwin J. Vieira has more in New York.
A bill in Congress could almost eliminate local input on cell tower location in New York and across the U.S. The American Broadband Deployment Act would create new restrictions on local and state land use and zoning laws to make it easier to site telecommunication towers. Multiple groups are sharing their concerns in a letter to the chair of the House Communications and Technology Subcommittee about the consequences of bypassing state and local zoning authorities. W. Scott McCullough, an attorney and advocate, describes some of the views about cell towers from homeowners and neighborhoods.
They don't want it by their children's school. It devalues people's homes, the property. It raises their insurance. Did you know that you have to disclose when you sell your home that you've got a cell tower next to your house or near your house? And the reason is that it's a property devaluation item.
Proponents of the bill say it will expand internet access. It passed out of committee on a party line 27-23 vote with strong Republican support. A similar bill was in the New York State Legislature this year, but didn't make it out of committee. There are mixed views about whether cell towers have health impacts. The American Cancer Society finds the radiation level is too low to cause health effects on humans, but some studies suggest otherwise. McCullough is convinced that cell towers can have a slew of environmental impacts.
RF radiation, in and of itself, is detrimental to life. It interferes with pollinators' ability to navigate. But one of the things I keep hearing from people who have had a tower up near their houses, all of a sudden the animals are gone.
A 2022 study finds even low levels of RF radiation inhibits a bee's sense of smell and short-term memory. And while some research suggests cell tower radiation can impact birds' navigation, the National Audubon Society has found otherwise. I'm Edwin J. Vieira, New York News Connection.
Hey, man, você que fechou a porta. Hey, man, e não deu beijo na boca. Hey, man, atura minha canhota.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Counterspin, your look behind the headlines with fairness and accuracy in reporting. At 6, it's Rising Up with Sona Lee. Then at 7, Civic Cipher. Tonight's weather will be clear, with wind gusts up to 14 miles an hour and an overnight low of 58 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be sunny and warm, with a daytime high of 88 degrees. Today in history, in 1920, the 19th Amendment to the Constitution was ratified, guaranteeing women the right to vote. The quote of the day is from Ghanaian diplomat and former Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, who died this day in 2018. He said, "No one is born a good citizen. No nation is born a democracy."
Amen. Você que fechou a porta. Amen. E não deu beijo na boca. Amen. Atura minha canhota. Se liga no passo que ela vem e te entorta. Amen. Não adianta ficar me olhando.
A new project at the University of Wisconsin-Madison aims to help indigenous students with financial aid. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Native college students face many obstacles in higher education, including overwhelming costs and not feeling culturally connected on campus. But those behind a Wisconsin project say another barrier is not having support in seeking financial aid. Mike Moen has more.
The University of Wisconsin-Madison Star Lab is using a $500,000 foundational grant to create a one-stop shop for indigenous students to find scholarship programs and other forms of financial relief specifically geared for them. Project co-leader Gresham Collum says the searchable database will hopefully create more awareness that slipped by him when he was a college student.
I'm a first descendant member of the Stockbridge-Munsee-Mohegan tribe, which means I'm not a formally enrolled member. And a lot of these scholarship policies are based on formal enrollment in a federally recognized tribe.
But he later found out when his sister was enrolling that there was a handful of schools in the U.S. with free tuition programs for first descendant natives. Collum says he hopes the effort also compels more higher ed institutions to expand opportunities and update policies. He notes it can go beyond traditional financial aid.
A lot of indigenous students come from low-income areas where they have Pell Grant funding. And what I would like to see is a lot of these programs expand their offerings to cover costs like childcare, health care, basic cost of living.
Collum predicts the database will not only be web-friendly, but mobile-friendly, too, knowing that many Native students come from tribal areas with limited access to high-speed internet.
That was Mike Moen reporting. The Barbie doll has been getting much attention with the release last month of the Barbie movie. In Alaska, mother Angela Gonzalez and daughter Ermelina of Anchorage posted their doll titled Fish Camp Barbie on social media, which features an Athabascan Barbie doll dressed in traditional clothing. It's gained thousands of views. KNOM's Ava White reports.
In this scene, a Barbie doll proudly wears a vibrant hot pink cusbuck, complemented by a beaded necklace, stylish moose hide cuffs, and headband. Positioned on a nearby table is a fish made from salmon skin aligned with beadwork. Barbie is holding an ulu, ready to skillfully prepare her fish. All clothing was handmade by Ermelina Gonzalez. Angela Gonzalez's family's fish camp was located along the Koyukuk River, where her family frequented when she was a young girl. She has played with Barbie since she was a little kid and says that her grandmother used to make accessories for her dolls.
You know, all the dolls need to have their liberty and
We would have like a little fish camp theme with fish rack.
Angela Gonzalez explains the importance of sharing culture towards younger generations and why it's important for Alaska Native children to feel equally represented.
That they will be able to see themselves represented, even though it's not for mass market or anything like that, and that they can be inspired to create what they want to create. You know, maybe they can make a fishnet or a dip net, you know, just something that can inspire them.
Barbie has a reputation for embracing numerous roles, ranging from a CEO to a gymnast, a construction worker, and now a skilled fisherwoman at a subsistence camp. Through the innovative creation of their own Barbie scenes, Angela and Ermelina Gonzalez have succeeded in fashioning a compelling narrative focused on culture. Their efforts serve as an inspiring testament for young girls across various Alaska Native cultures, conveying the powerful message that they, too, can embody the spirit of Barbie in their own unique ways. Reporting from Nome, Alaska, I'm Ava White.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
The phrase extreme partisanship often gets thrown around when referring to today's political discourse. That's led to questions about whether politicians and voters can find ways to be civil toward each other. One expert says the current environment presents challenges, but also hints at ways to shed hostilities. KBOO's Grant Button joins us again with more.
August is National Civility Month, and finding common ground in politics without name-calling might seem like an insurmountable task. A South Dakota expert says a lot of factors led to this point, but some brave steps could ease the tension. South Dakota State University political science David Wiltsey says researchers have noticed a rise in negative partisanship. Influenced by what they see on social media, he says people's enthusiasm for their own political party is outweighed by a desire to demonize those aligned with the other major party.
So what's driving your partisanship is more of a sense of how different and how corrupt or evil your opposition is.
Wiltsey says politicians pick up on these cues, leading to extreme rhetoric on the campaign trail, especially for primary elections. But he says it's up to the political elite to put a stop to it. Just like voters becoming more isolated from people with different viewpoints, he says members of Congress don't spend as much time around each other working on solutions as much as they used to. But it's not just about leaders fostering an environment that reestablishes relationship building among federal lawmakers. Wiltsey suggests politicians calling out members of their own party to tone down hateful or inaccurate rhetoric could help turn the tide.
It's not as if every single politician is behaving this way. It's just you've got enough who really are fueling this incivility and really trying to use that as their pathway to power.
He cites the late U.S. Senator John McCain in his 2008 presidential bid as an example of bravery that still might work today. The Arizona Republican confronted his own supporters for spreading inflammatory comments about his opponent, Barack Obama. Wiltsey says while McCain's bid for the White House wasn't successful, his efforts in addressing some of the nasty behavior appeared to be effective. For KBOO News and the Public News Service, I'm Grant Bunn.
The mushroom foraging season is about to begin in Oregon, but what about cultivating your own mushrooms to eat at home? One local farm is helping to give people more access to growing mushrooms for food with better tools and information. KBOO's Zoe Carina spoke with Luis Munoz of Irie Farms to learn more.
Mushrooms are a versatile and delicious food that have captured the hearts of many around the world. A farmer in Gresham, Oregon, began his journey with a fascination for the fungus. Now he has turned his curiosity into a business, Irie Farms. Hello. Can you please introduce yourself and tell us what got you into mushroom farming?
My name is Luis Munoz. What got me into mushrooms was just the fact that they were so similar to us, like as a species.
And you've been farming now for a little over a year. What are you currently growing?
Huitlacoche, which is the Mexican corn snap or Mexican truffle. That's where we inoculate the corn and turn it into a fungus and a mushroom.
And you're the first farmers to grow huitlacoche on U.S. soil. Why did you choose this particular mushroom?
I grew up in Mexico City, and my grandma is from Puebla. And in Puebla, it's a lot of farmland. So she was very used to the farm lifestyle. And one of those was huitlacoche. Huitlacoche was pretty big in the house. And just being able to bring it to the States and being able to give it to the especially the Hispanic community, it was very blissful.
You also offer a mentorship program for mushroom growers of all levels. What will folks experience if they enroll?
The mentorship is between the Sandy store where we do production, so they're able to see how production is done in a massive scale, and then they're also able to go to the farm where we're actually farming the mushroom.
And can you tell us more about your store?
Opening shop down on Sandy's been pretty interesting. A lot of people come in and think or under the impression that it's psilocybin. It's like when they come, we kind of have to just let them know, you know, hey, sorry. I don't know, hopefully in the future.
Have you noticed differences in how people think of psilocybin in the U.S. and in Mexico?
Or where I'm from, in Mexico, the way they see it is more like medicine, and either medicine for the heart or medicine for the body.
Besides the store on Sandy, where can folks find your mushrooms?
We are also doing a lot of business now with New Seasons. We're entering into their 19 stores.
Do you have any final words for our listeners?
Our method on this is to be able to see what we can do with mushrooms, innovate with mushrooms, and we just want to be able to offer Portland in particular just mushrooms.
And that was Luis Munoz from Irie Farms. I'm Zoe Carina with KBOO News. Thank you.
The World Cup is coming to a close at 3 a.m. tomorrow morning, and one famous baseball player is dealing with serious accusations at home. For more on these stories, it's Grant Button with KBOO's Sports News.
The Spain women's national team will play in their first Women's World Cup final on Sunday. That's despite not having a handful of their top players due to ongoing protests against the Royal Spanish Football Federation. In September of last year, 15 players asked to not be called up to the national team, citing concerns over a lack of professionalism demonstrated by the federation. The federation then ignored their concerns and demanded that they apologize before rejoining, leading 18 players to not play in multiple of Spain's friendly matches that fall. Eventually, some changes were made, but for Mapi Leon and two others, the changes were not enough for them to differ from their initial stance. Leon said, quote, "What saddens me the most is that I really have to miss out on something when I could have earned it and contributed. It's a shame," end quote. The protests and limited resolution hangs over Spain's World Cup run as a sign of how much the players have had to overcome in order to achieve a historic moment. They face off against England in the Women's World Cup final on Sunday and are favored to win at Yon 3 a.m. Moving to baseball, Tampa Bay Rays superstar Wander Franco has been accused of having inappropriate relationships with two minors, giving a clear explanation of why he hadn't been traveling with the team a few days beforehand and been placed on the Rays restricted list. His case is currently being investigated and trials will take place in Franco's home province in the Dominican Republic. According to a source very close to the investigations into the case of Wander Franco, they believe it is unlikely that Wander Franco will ever play in the MLB again. Yikes. For KBOO Sports News, I'm Grant Button.
Fishermen in New England are helping to monitor the impacts of an offshore wind project. The Commercial Fisheries Research Foundation is working with fishermen to gather data about the effectiveness of wind farms on marine species. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Offshore wind farms are being developed along the Atlantic coast. They can help the climate, but the effect on the fishing industry is uncertain.
And that's scary for people. So what we're trying to do is get the people that are on the water that are going to be affected by this change involved in the research that can help us assess the change.
David Bethany directs the Commercial Fisheries Research Foundation. He says wind companies are required to do fisheries monitoring surveys before, during, and after construction. His group is working with local fishermen to conduct those surveys for the South Fork Wind Farm, which is being built this year off southern New England's coast. So they're monitoring species in the area, from crabs and lobsters to monkfish and skates. They'll continue as the wind farm is built and afterwards to identify any impacts.
So do we see the same abundance of animals that we saw before? Do we see the same migration timing and movement patterns? Are they as healthy as they were?
The data will not only be used by the wind industry. Bethany's group will share it online, so fishermen can make sure their concerns are addressed as offshore wind energy expands. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Friday, August 18th, 2023. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Grant Button and Zoe Carina. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Laura Miller. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and Alex Gonzalez. The director of the Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Josh Salem.
And I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. Thank you. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for Countdown.